We're looking at a resolution by House Democrats to block President Trump's national emergency declaration to fund the border wall. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If the bill passes the House, the Senate would then be forced to take it up, putting Republicans on the record on whether they support the president's use of executive power. So should Congress attempt to challenge the president's order, or is this move by Democrats problematic to you? The wrong move at the wrong time? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. She teaches courses on African-American politics, political participation, and race in elections. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network. Hi, Andra. Welcome back.
Thanks. How are you?
Doing well. So let's look at what House Democrats introduced this resolution Friday to block President Trump's action on this emergency declaration. They are arguing that this undermines Congress's power of the purse. Can you help us understand their reasoning for the resolution?
Well, because President Trump invoked the National Emergencies Act in order to provide some of the funding that he is doing for the border wall, Congress does have the right to respond, because basically the National Emergencies Act gives the president the right to kind of reappropriate funds, and that's actually Congress's purview and responsibility. So they still actually do have some say-so in what goes on there. And so basically by challenging whether or not this is a national emergency, because the National Emergencies Act is actually pretty vague about what constitutes a national emergency, this is an attempt for the legislative branch to put a check on the executive branch and taking sort of this power that's kind of been given to them that's highly unusual. So basically this would be Congress's attempt to kind of veto it, but because it kind of goes through a sort of expedited bill passage process, the president actually does have the right to veto their resolution. And then if Congress can muster, both houses can muster two-thirds veto override, then that would actually stop the president from being able to reallocate the parts of the budget that fall under the purview of the National Emergencies Act. Not all of that. I think the reallocation will fall under that, though. But, yeah, this would be a way of them telling President Trump that he can't do an in run around Congress to be able to get the money that he didn't get in the most recent budget resolution.
Do we see House Democrats pretty much in lockstep here? Who really is pushing this resolution? Where did it come from?
Well, I mean, I think it comes from the fact that President Trump's invocation of an emergency here is highly controversial. So, you know, there have been national emergencies in the past. There have been times where the president has reallocated previously allocated funds from the budget to address national emergencies. So, for instance, when you have to do that in the wake of 9/11, for instance, I think, you know, most people agree that, you know, that's a highly sort of unusual circumstance, and that's not something that could have been anticipated, in an earlier, you know, budget type of deliberation. But to do it for the border wall, you know, to declare a national emergency when President Trump said it wasn't a national emergency, that he was doing it for expediency's sake, and to do it right after Congress had basically agreed to not fund the border wall at the level that he had requested. You know, there are many people who view this as sort of not keeping with the spirit of the National Emergencies Act, and actually not keeping in the spirit of separation of powers as articulated in the Constitution. So, I mean, you know, this is in part Congress's attempt to exert checks and balances on the executive branch.
So the House is controlled by Democrats, and it seems all but certain that this will pass. And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has said there were plans to introduce a companion bill in the upper chamber. Does this resolution stand a chance in the Senate?
Well, it has to come up in the Senate so Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, can kill it because this is highly unusual. It actually has to get taken up within 18 days of passage in the House. So he has to take it up, and it does actually have a chance of passing, in part because there are Republicans who are uncomfortable with the president's use of executive power in this particular way to try to use the border wall, and it's highly controversial. So, I mean, I don't think it's a sure thing that it gets through the Senate, but I think the question is, if it does get through the Senate, it is certainly going to be vetoed by the president. And then the question would be in both houses, just given how narrow the margins are actually in both chambers, whether or not you could either chamber could muster the two-thirds majority needed to override President Trump's veto.
We're talking about a House resolution that aims to block President Trump's use of a national emergency declaration to fund a border wall. Andra Gillespie is our guide. She's an associate professor of political science at Emory University. And as the political back and forth continues over border security, what do you want lawmakers to know? What questions do you have? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Roland now from Waukesha. Hi, Roland. What's on your mind about this?
Well, it just seems to be a non-issue. We're a nation that just blows huge money on everything. We just raised our defense budget by $70 billion a year. So if the wall is that much of a security issue, take some of that $70 billion raise and spend it on the wall. Like $20 billion, you know, it's likely that the wall is going to cost three times what they say anyways. Take that money and spend it. And at least if it doesn't work down the road, it'll get jobs for certain Americans and maybe increase the economies around the border.
So what Roland is saying there is this is more about politics than it is about the actual cost. Andra?
Well, I mean, I would actually sort of encourage him to think about the institutional roles and making sure that we preserve those roles. And so the issue here is that if Congress saw fit to allocate, you know, $25 or $60 billion to build the border wall, it was their responsibility to do so. The president's job, the executive branch's job, is to execute what's put in. And so they had a very vigorous debate about how much money to give to the wall. They chose in this latest round to only give a little less than $1.4 billion towards that wall. And so because Congress, because the people get to dictate how the money gets spent, it's a question of whether or not you let the president rewrite the budget, essentially, right? And that's not supposed to be the president's responsibility. That's an Article I responsibility. That is Congress's job. And so I think the big issue is not just the politics of it, not just, you know, the optics of the wall, but the idea that the president could lose a legislative battle. And then figure out how to do what he wants, you know, over and above that. And that's the issue that's at stake. And so, you know, we've talked in the last, you know, 50 years about the rise of the imperial presidency, where the president is getting more and more power. This is an issue where it looks like if Congress does not stand up to the president, some people are going to argue that you've now given the president so much power and they don't have any reason to try to sort of respect the divisions of power that the framers put in place when they wrote the Constitution.
We're talking with Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie about a move by House Democrats on Friday introducing a resolution to block the president's national emergency declaration. And it could come up for a vote tomorrow in the House. How do you want House members to vote on this? Do you want the Senate to take this up and be on the record about the national emergency declaration? We're at 800-642-1234. You can share your thoughts by email at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back to this conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the resolution by House Democrats to challenge President Trump's national emergency declaration. President Trump is pledging a veto if Congress passes the resolution. Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who also serves as a lieutenant colonel in the Wisconsin Air National Guard, was recently deployed to the U.S.-Mexico border. He said, based on what he's seen, there is a national emergency. And here he is yesterday on Face the Nation talking with moderator Margaret Brennan.
I won't vote to try to block it. Look, I wish this would have happened a different way. I voted for comprehensive immigration reform. I think Republicans and Democrats both have good ideas on immigration.
But you think this is constitutional for the president to bypass the power of the purse strings of Congress?
Yes.
So what do you think of the politics at work here? Are you for or against this attempt to upend the president's border funding plan? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Andra Gillespie is with us. She is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, this is a legislative pushback, you know, against the president. Is Congress out of line, or is this a proper role for the legislative branch?
No. I mean, I don't think Congress is out of line at all. The framers anticipated and wanted to have three co-equal branches of government. They wanted power diffused across these three branches so that we weren't in danger of recreating the monarchy. That was what we were leaving when we broke off from Great Britain. So it is actually Congress's responsibility to provide a check and a balance on the president. They should, you know, keep the powers that they have. They are responsible to oversee what happens in the executive branch. So there are lots of things that, you know, may look uncomfortable in a highly partisan environment, but that are absolutely supposed to happen. So Congress gets to sort of set the tone, you know, when Congress gets to set spending. So even though the president offers up a budget, it's actually Congress's responsibility starting in the House to introduce a budget bill, which means they get the right to write the budget. It also means that Congress has the right to oversee the executive branch, which means they get to call in members of the administration and ask them what's going on, because they have the right to fund everything that's going on in the executive branch. And if they don't like what they see, then they have the right to defund it.
Let's go to another call now. Gary is joining us from Merrill. Good morning, Gary.
Yes, good morning. I don't think there should be any emergency at all. Congress should do the same thing that they did with President Obama and President Bush. They should give him the money that he wants for his portion of the wall. The way it's talked about, there's no wall at all. But we got to remember, there's hundreds and hundreds of miles of wall that were put in by other presidents. And it is our president's responsibility to secure the borders. And Congress, while in the Democrats, there isn't anything that this president would like to do for the country that they don't oppose for political reasons.
And so what Gary's saying, Andra, is kind of echoed in what Senator Lindsey Graham said this weekend on Fox News, and I want to just play a clip momentarily here.
A handful, but here's the point. Trump sent troops to the border. Obama sent troops to the border. Bush sent troops to the border. What's the difference of deploying forces to the border to secure it versus having them build a barrier while they're there?
Mm-hmm. Andra, how would you react to that?
So, you know, certainly as the head of the executive branch, President Trump can, you know, send people to the border as part of comprehensive security, as part, you know, arguably of national defense. There are budgetary line items that would actually help to pay for those kinds of things. But in terms of sort of a capital project like a wall, right, that's something that has to be debated, and it's been debated. And so right now, President Trump's allies in Congress have not been persuasive enough to persuade a majority of their colleagues to be able to vote to pay for the wall at the level that President Trump wants to be able to do this. So, part of this is that, you know, President Trump can get elected on this, and he can convince his constituents that this is a good idea. But one, we have to look at the national public opinion data that says that the majority of Americans are not convinced that this is necessary. And then is that also being reflected in the attitudes of the legislators who represent all of these constituents? So if there is to be a wall, I would argue that the proper way of going about doing this from a procedural standpoint is to convince a majority of members of Congress that this wall is necessary and to support this. And so that hasn't happened yet. And so let's not short-circuit the process that's there that actually allows for deliberation, that allows for persuasion, that allows for ideas to be tested in the marketplace of ideas. And that's not what we've seen happen yet. But in the marketplace of ideas, there are a number of different proposals to secure the border. I think it's really important to point out that even people who support the wall don't oppose measures to secure the border, to make it safe, and to make sure that we are promoting legal and not illegal immigration. So, you know, there are lots of ways to secure the border. So personnel is an issue that has come up. People have talked about technology in terms of sensors. And so if those issues are coming up, those actually get a lot more support congressionally from leaders. And so those things should, you know, be pursued. And it's true. There are almost 700 miles of wall already along that border. That's more than 2,000 miles long. There's some places where it doesn't make sense to have a border because there are rivers, because there are mountains. So you're going to have to use all of these strategies. And so the wall sort of sounds nice and it sounds simple, but I think we have to ask ourselves at this point, since there isn't consensus to be able to build the type of wall that President Trump wants to build, whether or not he's encountering this opposition for politics' sake or because the idea needs more vetting. And if the idea was vetted more, perhaps the end proposal would be something that doesn't look like all wall all the time. And we've even seen President Trump back off from that. But we need to have a conversation about this, about sort of what's motivating sort of calling for the wall as the primary protector, and then whether or not that barrier is actually most effective in terms of being able to address the problems. I mean, and we haven't even begun to talk about port security and talked about the things about drug interdiction that are actually really a problem and that a wall probably isn't going to fix.
So, Andra, what should we here in Wisconsin be watching for on this national emergency declaration and the politics behind it as we watch Congress this week?
So one of the things I would pay attention to is the margin, because that is a harbinger of whether or not a possibility of a veto override is even plausible. Does it mean that you could sort of, you know, something could pass narrowly on the first go round and then, you know, you couldn't get more votes on a veto override later on? But, you know, one of the things is that, you know, if this passes with, you know, 55% of the vote or 60% of the vote, sort of how close is that to the 67%, the supermajority that you need in order to be able to get it past President Trump's veto. Then the other thing to pay attention to, and I think what a lot of people anticipate, is that assuming Congress can't override President Trump's veto of the resolution, I think a bigger question will be sort of, you know, what is this going to look like in the judicial system? So that's the other check on the executive branch. And so, you know, we already know that a number of states have been bringing forward lawsuits to protest the border wall. So what we expect is that if Congress can't stop this wall, there would likely be an injunction that comes out of the federal courts. And so once we see that and we see what rationale judges use to enjoin the wall, we'll see whether or not that can, you know, hold muster as it works its way through the court system and probably up to the Supreme Court.
Andra, before we have to let you go, can we take a look very quickly here at the special counsel Robert Mueller's probe? There was reports that came out saying that he was going to release a report. Now he's not expected to deliver his findings to the Justice Department this week. But despite that, some lawmakers are using this willy won't he anticipation for this public report. And let's hear Senator Kamala Harris of California.
This is an extraordinary moment in terms of the need that the special counsel has to investigate the conduct of the president of the United States campaign and issues surrounding it. I believe that, given in particular all the misinformation that we can, I think rightly believe we've heard, that it is important that the American public receive as much information and that we be as transparent as possible.
So where is this report, and will Americans see it?
The Mueller team isn't releasing it this week, in part because President Trump is headed to Vietnam to the summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. So, just sort of in deference to the international diplomacy that's going on this week, Mueller is not going to sort of present a distraction there. We only know from reports that that it's close to being done, so we don't know exactly sort of, when this report is going to be done yet. What we do know is that by statute, Mueller has to present the report to the Attorney General, and then Bob Barr will make the decision about how much of the report is going to be released. There's some stuff that should not be released if it really is highly confidential, and then it becomes a question about whether or not they are selective in terms of what else gets released.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. Coming up next, we learn about a documentary that unearthed pre-World War II footage of a Nazi rally in New York. It got an Oscar nomination. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Here with us on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A short documentary called A Night at the Garden was nominated for an Academy Award last night. It's a haunting look at a forgotten bit of American history in the days before World War II. Here is WPR's Judith Sears-Poisson.
Marshall Curry is the filmmaker behind the short documentary, A Night at the Garden. Marshall, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your film, A Night at the Garden, is a 7-minute compilation of archival footage from a gathering of the German-American Bund at Madison Square Garden in New York City in 1939. How did you first become aware of this gathering?
I was at dinner with a friend of mine who was writing a screenplay that takes place in New York in 1939. And he told me that there had been a rally that year in which 20,000 Americans filled Madison Square Garden to celebrate Nazism. And I didn't believe him at the time, actually, until I got home that night and looked it up. And I got an archival researcher who was a friend to start digging around, and he found some footage in the National Archive and some in UCLA's archive and Grinberg Archive. And so we gathered it, and when I saw it, I just couldn't believe it.
And were those 20,000 people in Madison Square Garden all members of the German-American Bund, or who were they?
Well, they were supporters at some level of the Bund or of the Bund's philosophy. So it's kind of incredible to think that there could be 20,000 Americans, New Yorkers in a pretty progressive city that would come out to support fascism and anti-Semitism. And unfortunately, when there's 20,000 that come out for a rally, you know that there are a lot more than that that are supportive, but just couldn't get a babysitter that night. Mm.
For those who haven't seen it yet, describe what this looked like.
Well, it's very surreal. The film starts with a shot of the garden, and you think, oh, well, maybe this is going to be about a basketball game or a hockey game. And then we go into the marquee of Madison Square Garden, and it describes it as a pro-America rally. And so maybe you think, well, this is going to be some patriotic gathering. And when you get inside, you see that there are American flags everywhere. Behind the stage, there's a 30-foot portrait of George Washington. But when you look closer, you realize that there are swastikas on either side, and that the people, the thousands of people who are marching into the hall, are carrying American flags, but also flags with swastikas. And then a speaker takes the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow American patriots,
and starts attacking the press and demonizing minorities, and eventually a protester runs out on stage and is beaten up.
Tell us about that protester. Who was that?
His name was Isidore Greenbaum. He was just a Jewish plumber's assistant from Brooklyn, just as a 20-something-year-old, went down to the rally to see what this was all about, and was so shocked by what he saw that he ran out on stage to try to say something and was beaten up and thrown off stage and eventually arrested. And the next day, according to the New York Times, at his hearing, the magistrate who was sentencing him said to him, "Don't you realize that someone could have been hurt? And Isidore Greenbaum replied that, don't you realize that someone's going to be hurt by the things that were being said up there? And of course, this is 1939. We know what happened in the next few years.
Your film is presented with no added narration, so you're really letting what we see and hear tell the story without additional context or analysis. How did you decide that that would be the most effective approach?
Well, when I first saw the footage, my first instinct was to make a traditional historical documentary where you have historians provide context and you understand what's going on. And almost on a whim, I decided to try editing it without any explanation. So almost like a Verite documentary, or like most movies where nobody interrupts to tell you what you're seeing. And I discovered that it had a real power. It pulled the audience in as you're watching this stuff, and you're thinking, what is this? How did this happen? How did I never know about this? And those questions draw the audience in and engage them more deeply than maybe it would have if everything had been delivered like a tidy history lesson.
I pledge undivided allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And now we turn to Mark D. Van Els. He's a professor of history at Queensborough Community College of the City University of New York. He's a Wisconsin native and received his PhD in history from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, Mark, have you watched this film, A Night at the Garden?
Yes, I have watched the film. It was very interesting. And I suppose, like a lot of Americans, what I was immediately brought back to was the Charlottesville episode. And it seemed to me you could draw some parallels between what we've seen recently and what was in that film. Some of those issues are still very timely, unfortunately.
Well, tell us more about the German-American Bund on the national level to start with.
Yeah. All right. Well, it really has its origins with the Nazi movement in Germany, which began to emerge in the 1920s. Germany had been defeated in the First World War. Its economy was ravaged, and it was undergoing a great deal of political turmoil. There was a strong communist movement that was beginning to develop in Germany, and the rise of the communist movement in turn led to the rise of the fascist movement, the Nazi Party. Many of the people who would later become activists in the German-American Bund in the United States had been in the German army during the First World War, had participated in some of the political street fighting that occurred in Germany immediately after the war, and they emigrated to America to, like most immigrants do, I suppose, have a better life. But when they came, they oftentimes brought their Nazi ideology with them. They started to form small pro-Nazi groups, actually in coordination with officials back in Germany. And then when Hitler took power in 1933, these smaller groups came together to form something called the Friends of the New Germany, which created a rift between the U.S. and German governments, because there was a Nazi-affiliated movement right here in the United States. So the Friends of the New Germany was sort of rebranded, as we would say today, and it becomes the German-American Bund, or America-Deutscher Volksbund, as it would be in German. This new organization was not affiliated with the Nazi Party, at least officially. Membership was limited to American citizens, and so there were no foreign nationals in the organization. But of course, the organization still kept its pro-Nazi sympathies.
And of course, here in Wisconsin, especially southeastern Wisconsin, there was a very large German population. Who among our fellow Wisconsinites were drawn to the Bund's message?
Well, I'm glad to say not that many. It was mostly those people who had immigrated to America after the First World War. Something like 90% of known Bund members were recent immigrants to the United States. The Bund hoped to infiltrate the more traditional German-American communities, the sports clubs, the singing organizations, and that led to a big rift within the German-American community itself. At first, the larger German-American community tried to ignore the problem, but when the Bund got more assertive, when it became more publicly visible, that led to an open break among German-Americans.
The Bund also ran a youth camp in Wisconsin, in Grafton, called Camp Hindenburg. What went on there?
The Bund, as it was organized, bore some striking similarities to the Nazi Party in Germany itself. There was, for example, something called the Ordnungsdienst, or Order Division, much like the stormtroopers you found in Nazi Germany with the jack boots and the brown shirts and all these sorts of things. And in Germany, infamously, there was something called the Hitler Youth, the Hitler Jugend, and there was that equivalent in the German-American Bund as well. It was called the Jugendschaft. The Bund liked to portray it as the equivalent of the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. You know, we're getting the kids out of the city and into God's free air and all these types of things, but they're also learning about Nazi ideology. So it was remarkably like the Hitler Youth back in Germany.
What effect did America's entrance into World War II have on the Bund?
Well, if you go back even to 1939, one of the main reasons why the Bund grew as much as it did was fear of communism. And just before World War II started in Europe, Hitler signed a deal with the Soviet Union. And so that sort of took the wind out of their anti-communist sails, I suppose you could say. That was one of the main reasons why the Bund was growing. With Hitler's deal with Stalin, then that was sort of taken off the table. Another factor, I think, is that Germany was a rising power and posed a threat to the United States. So this is also the time, let's talk about 1938, 1939, this is when Austria is absorbed into the German Reich, the Munich Conference, appeasement. And as Germany starts to look more and more threatening to the United States, a lot of other Americans began to look askance at the German-American Bund. And then, of course, once America enters the war, many of these people they lose their citizenship, some sent off to internment camps and things like that. But by 1941, the Bund was already really on the ropes. It was after the Second World War begins in Europe that the Bund really begins to show a very sharp decline.
Earlier, you mentioned the white nationalists who were demonstrating in Charlottesville, Virginia, and with tragic consequences. Do you see parallels that should be drawn or could be drawn between the political climate at the time of the Bund and rhetoric today?
Yeah. So these extreme right-wing groups, they always sort of remind me of the main character in one of these slasher movies. Just when you think you've gotten rid of them, the killer always pops up from under the bed or out of the closet or something like this. It does seem to crop up from time to time based on various social conditions in the country. In the 1930s, it was the Great Depression, the rise of communism in this country. It was another reason why a lot of people, some people turned to the German-American Bund. Today's discussions about immigration have brought up many of those feelings and have brought many of these right-wing groups back out into the open more.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was WPR's Judith Sears-Poisson talking with filmmaker Marshall Curry and historian Mark D. Van Els, who's a native of Wisconsin. Their short documentary features archival footage of a Nazi rally in New York before the start of World War II. Just ahead, the National Resources Management Act recently passed in the House. We'll find out how it impacts public lands across the nation. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a massive public lands package that is expected to pass the House this week and already a Senate approval. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The centerpiece of this bipartisan legislation is the permanent reauthorization of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Here is Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who chairs the Energy and Natural Resources Committee.
I think it is important to remind folks that it's a lands package. It addresses so many of the issues related to water. It is a sportsman's package, and it is truly a conservation package.
What do you think Wisconsin needs when it comes to public lands? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Stephen Davis is a political science professor at Edgewood College in Madison. He is the author of In Defense of Public Lands, The Case Against Privatization and Transfer. Stephen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks.
So we know this is a sweeping package of conservation bills, but at the heart, what does this do?
Well, it has a bunch of different parts, and the two main things it does is set aside various pieces of federal land. Most of it's already controlled by the federal government, but it gives it new levels of protection. Names about 1.3 million acres to the Wilderness Preservation System. It protects this very beautiful, iconic area of Utah called the San Rafael Swell, creates a new national recreation area, creates four new national parks, including one really known for its dinosaur bones and fossils called Jurassic. And the other ones are historic, including Medgar Evers' home where he was assassinated in Mississippi. 620 miles of national of wild and scenic river is added to the system, which is kind of like the wilderness, the river version of the Wilderness Act. And it bans mining on some key parcels right outside of Yellowstone and North Cascades that were threatened by large mines right up to the park's border. It expands a few national parks. So that's the land conservation piece of this. And then the other part, and to most environmentalists, this is the most important part, it permanently reauthorizes the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which was a fund that was created in 1965 to take royalties from offshore drilling and create a fund sort of to offset the environmental harm done by oil drilling, to create this fund that would be used for land acquisition for parks or programs in parks at the state, local, or federal level. So everything from like soccer fields and swing sets and city parks all the way to adding, you know, buying up in-holdings in national parks or expanding them. So that had expired in September and had environmentalists really worried because that this key pot of money for giving grants and piecing together purchases of public land. So that was reauthorized without an end date.
How big of a deal is this legislation?
It's really surprising. I mean, things like this used to be much more common in the 1970s or 80s. For this time we're in right now, this is very surprising that it not only passed the Senate, but by a 92-8 margin. And it kind of harkens back to a more bipartisan conservation era. So it caught a lot of people by surprise, the kind of sweeping nature of the bill and the seeming enthusiasm with which Congress passed it, because this is not what we have seen in the last decade or more.
What do we see its impact here in Wisconsin? What would this package of bills accomplish here on the home front?
There's no specific parcels of our federal land that get expanded or changed. There's no new wilderness in Wisconsin. The closest is in Voyageurs National Park in Minnesota. There is some boundary adjustments, and the park is made slightly larger. But what's really important here in Wisconsin is that this Land and Water Conservation Fund, which we rely on for everything from county land and city parks to potentially additions to, say, Apostle Islands, or if that were in the cards in the future, it would very likely involve some funding from the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
We're talking about sweeping legislation that would make the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanent. It passed the Senate earlier this month. It's up for a vote, perhaps this week in the House. Stephen Davis is with us. He's a political science professor at Edgewood College in Madison. Stephen, the bill passed the Senate 92-8, and here in Wisconsin, it got a yes vote from Senator Tammy Baldwin, a no from Senator Ron Johnson, and Senator Johnson had offered an amendment on wolf management plans that wasn't part of the final package. He says he voted no because the amendment didn't make it in. So what stands out to you when you consider what Congress did not include in this legislation?
Well, I mean, potentially, this is a very wide-ranging bill, but the way it was constructed, it was to keep out the most contentious and controversial pieces of conservation issues like endangered species. That is something that people people in Congress and the constituents across the country have very polarized views on. And if you wanted to build a pass this way, you had to do some old-fashioned, what we call log rolling, in that, you know, keep it at a level that everyone could agree with and sprinkle the goodies around, you know, coast to coast, so you see that there's a little something for everyone. And when you're doing that, you will often block out amendments that are controversial. And to a lot of senators, legislatively messing with endangered species designations is really controversial, and they didn't want it in there. So there's no surprise that that's not in there. Environmentally minded senators, I'm sure, had a huge wish list as well that they pretty much kept out. So this was kind of tightly focused on federal land and its designations and the money we use to buy federal land.
And what happens if the president chooses to veto this? Is there any sense of what he might do?
Yeah, there, most observers think that he'll probably go along with it, mostly because this is not an area that is kind of a signature issue of his. And so if something passes by such a large margin in both houses, he probably won't stand in its way. If he were to veto it, which, you know, he's sometimes a bit unpredictable, you never know, there are clearly enough votes in the Senate to override this veto. The House, it's not quite clear. And Republicans in the House may not be as positive about this bill. Since the Democrats control the House, it'll still pass, but there may not be a veto-proof majority, which is two-thirds.
And you study public lands, and this is a bipartisan package around conservation with a focus on public lands. Do you see any shifting sentiment among lawmakers about how we protect public lands?
Yes, definitely. That's the most surprising thing about this is 45 Republicans voted yes on this, and of those 45, most in 2015 had previously voted on a very controversial bill. It was an amendment to a budget bill to actually transfer large chunks of federal land to the states to do with as they please. And this was widely seen as an attempt to kind of break up America's federal public land domain. And for these same senators to then turn around and seemingly enthusiastically support this very different bill, which confirms and further protects federal land and makes available money to buy more of it, shows that something is really shifting. And we've had a decade of really radical bills coming out of the House to privatize chunks of public land, to transfer it to the states, to keep the federal government from, you know, patrolling and being essentially the chief law enforcement officers on their own federal land. All kinds of bills like this.
Well, we'll be watching. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
Stephen Davis is a political science professor at Edgewood College in Madison, author of In Defense of Public Lands, The Case Against Privatization and Transfer, joining us to talk there about the Natural Resources Management Act, which the U.S. Senate approved earlier this month, and the House could take it up as early as this week. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.